I'm going to resume my comments on Uniontown days. There were several incidents which I forgot to mention, and I've recalled others. And now that I've received word from you that you approve of this procedure, I will go ahead and add anything that I can think of. Our home, which was a two-story brick house, rather large, and with a very delightful side porch on which we did a great deal of our living during the seasonable portions of the year. I might describe it because I've never seen another one quite like it. It was up about 10 steps or more above the ground level. The roof of the porch extended beyond the house quite a ways. The overhead of the porch itself was the second story of the house, a side porch upstairs off my bedroom or the nursery. The front hall led directly into the side porch. The main door or side doors of the porch led into the dining room. We always had a sort of a Gloucester hammock on the porch, and of course a number of chairs. But the fact that the roof of the porch, which was really the roof of the steps down to the yard level and beyond, extended at least 10 feet beyond the foot of the steps and had quite a slope to it. Upstairs, off the rear room, which was the nursery and my bedroom, the side porch had grapes along an arbor. The leader from the grapes around our spring house passed over to a large maple tree, which early in my youth collapsed. That is, the top fell off, leaving more than a stump. And this leader from the grapevine passed on to the upstairs porch, so that it was possible for me as a boy, during the season of the bearing of the grapes, to step out of bed and walk out in my bare feet on the porch and pull down bunches of delicious Concord grapes and another variety which I've forgotten. I'm struck by the fact today how easy it was to grow things in those days. Every bunch was more or less perfect. Now today at our Leesburg place, unless we put each bunch early in a sack, it is ruined by worms, and I've never grown a successful crop of grapes up there, though I have 10 varieties. But in my boyhood, the arbor around the springhouse was covered with grapes, and the extension to the side upstairs porch had two varieties which bore prodigiously, though that is hardly the word. The house was on a level with the street, the National Pike I've referred to, but the side of the house towards the creek was very much lower, and the retaining wall was about 8 feet tall and was actually the approach to the bridge over the creek of the National Pike. Right here is this damn thing. Oh, I've got it. another incident of my young boyhood was the very pleasant habit of young men, young lawyers and so forth, who lived at the hotel, one of the hotels in the town. And as there were no golf course, there were no clubs, there was no club, there was no place for them to go much on Sundays, and nothing to do. My family, my father and mother, were from Kentucky, and they were accustomed to a very bountiful living and continual hospitality. There were always people for meals. There were always many around. That was not the case at all at home. They had very old families that went back to the early days, but they entertained very little, and particularly on Sundays led a very austere life. On the contrary, mother and father enjoyed having young people about, meaning young men, for example. And the habit soon formed of half a dozen of these young fellows coming to our house on Saturday afternoon and sitting out in what we called the backyard, which was the edge of the orchard and not far from the creek. They're built up at home the first ice plant in that part of the country. And I became a temporary employee of the ice plant whenever I could get the job and have the time in the summer. So it is a very easy matter for me to put the choice watermelons my father picked out in the room where the ice blocks were stored. So on Sunday afternoon, I would go to the ice plant with my wagon and haul a couple of watermelons home on a black Japan tin waiter. Father would carve these melons out in the yard with an admiring group of young men and cut them into large V-like slices, and everybody of the male variety in their shirt sleeves would sit and eat watermelon and squirt the seeds out on the lawn. That became a regular business during the watermelon season, and I think was the only entertainment offered in the town of any kind, except to sit in the hotel lounge window and look out at the street, which is more or less vacant on a day like that. But I always remember these watermelon festivals, and they persisted the entire length of the watermelon season. And as I recall, the melons cost about 10 cents apiece. Another thing at that period, which I overlooked the other day, was my employment in the church, St. Peter's Episcopal Church. I pumped the organ, which was, the place for the pump was in a very narrow region in rear of the organ, and the pump was just a handle, like the tiller of a boat. And the pumping was not difficult, except you had to be there. But there was a long period of wait during the sermon. And on one of these mornings, I was occupying this period of waiting by reading a 5-cent novel of that day about Nick Carter, just in the most exciting portion, and it was very much like Jesse James. My attention was called to the organ by the thump-thump which the organist, Miss Fanny Howe, could make from the keyboard, and I realized that she had started to play at the end of the sermon and no music was coming out. So I pumped the organ very hurriedly, and of course she was not only displeased, but rather outraged. Miss Fanny was a very fine person, a woman well-to-do, of one of the old families there, and was a great pillar of strength in the church. I have said in recent years that she relieved me from duty with the organ. I think she did, but I'm not certain. At least I can't remember who took my place. I mention this because I've seen it referred to several times. Another item of my youth, which made a great impression on me at the time, was my inability to make a speech, meaning a recitation. I seemed utterly unable to do this. And when I went to public school, they had just had an addition of a very large assembly room, which took in most of the pupils. They could all sit in there for these Friday afternoon occasions. And I had to recite on this particular Friday. I've never forgotten this because I never again have experienced quite such agony. So I looked through the book. I remember pieces of poetry and matters of that kind. I remember one was riding down from Bangor on the evening train. And this particular one, which caught my fancy because of its excitement, was Asleep at the Switch. When this boy goes to sleep when he's watching the switch and the train is going to be wrecked. And as I recall, he wakes up to find it a dream. However it was, I contracted to recite Asleep at the Switch to the more or less entire public school. And as they got started on their programs, and mine wasn't until towards the last, I realized I'd forgotten entirely a part of one verse. Well, I struggled in every way with my memory, and I couldn't recall what that verse was. So I sat there in agony, knowing that my turn was coming, and I couldn't recite, because I couldn't remember one of the leading verses, or at least a portion of it. And I went through a positive agony there, which was much prolonged because the program stretched out quite far. But this eventually saved my life because the time ran out and the session was dismissed, and with it passed from my life Asleep at the Switch. I never had to make any talk, I don't think, until years later when I was senior captain at the VMI and I had to talk about to the whole corps at some meeting when we were under duress, as it were, and a member of the Board of Visitors was there to state their side of the question, and I was called upon to state the side of the cadets. But I don't recall any previous recitation, speech, or anything until that occasion. And I don't recall any after that for many, many years. So my talent, whatever it was certainly not existent at that time. Speaking of the very attractive side porch of our house, which was connected to the front door by a straight hall, reminds me of another affair which now delights my wife. My sister's schoolmate from her school in Philadelphia was the daughter of the governor of Pennsylvania at that time, Haskell. Some might remember that he is referred to in a very flattering way by Li Hung Chang in his supposed diary of his journal of his trip to America. Anyway, Helen Haskell arrived, and she was a very pretty girl, and was going to be entertained at a 500 party on this back porch on a pleasant summer day. And the stipulation of my sister was that I was barred from the house during this party because she regarded me as a rather turbulent member of the household. So I retired across the street to my chum's house yard, and we went back to the stable in their backyard to find some activity that would amuse us. And we stirred up a bee's nest. Well, it was quite the fashion in those days to fight bees. You whittle out a handle on a shingle and cut some air holes so that it would be easier to swing. And with this sort of tennis-like paddle, you proceeded to fight the bees. You stirred them up and they came at you and you hit at them. And if you had bad luck, you got badly stung. So we were fighting bees. And in the group, I remember, the boy that led to my misfortune was named Bowman, Herbert Bowman, who became a famous Yale athlete. I think he was pitcher of the baseball team, fullback on the football team, and broad jumper on the track team, all in his first year. And he displayed these talents in a battle with me when we were both trying to get under the other to protect us against this bee, which is determined to get it. We'd were hitting in every way with our paddles, and we broke our paddles on each other, not intentionally, and we're having a desperate fight, and the bee was just humming right in the rear of our hair line, and it was a desperate effort to get free of the bee that I broke loose, and the bee chased me. And I came from the far backyard of my chum's house and passed his house in a flash, and I crossed the street, and the front door was open. It was a summer afternoon, and I went straight down the long hall, and then I remembered at the last moment that I was forbidden the house, and the card party was going on the side porch, peaceful and delightful. So I turned to the right and went off into the dining room, but the bee went straight ahead and stung the guest of honor, Helen Hastings, and I didn't dare come home for late that night. That's an actual fact. It stung the girl. They wouldn't believe me. They claimed I took the bee in there. My reputation wasn't very good. I recalled, after my dictation the other day, one item connected with our greenhouse, which was the next door to the carriage house, where we painted it green as much as we could in order to keep in line with the name for these flower shops. We learnt, in the first place, we, with a great struggle, made a flag. It was white, some kind of cloth, and on it, with great difficulty, we printed Marshall and Thompson, Florists, below the name. The only trouble was we left out the L, and it was Forests. We made a pole beside the house and hoisted our flag, and that stood as our advertisement of our greenhouse. When our home there was broken up, I was away, of course. Matter of fact, I was in the army then, I think. My mother found in the attic this famous flag. And while she kept many things that I couldn't understand her for keeping, she destroyed our flag, which I would have delighted in having today. The other thing about the greenhouse was that we learned that the congressman in those days would get you free seeds from Washington. Free seeds. That is the only thing free we could think of, so we, on our toy typewriter, we wrote to our congressman, who I'd never seen because he was from another town, and I never did see our congressman until long after I was in the army. Anyway, we wrote to him for free seeds, and in due time there came from the agricultural department a packet of seeds. The only trouble was they were cotton seed, which was sort of out of place in Pennsylvania. However, we planted them, and they grew a little in our strawberry boxes, but that was not much of a success. I recall years later, when I was before a committee of Congress, hearing a remark by one of the members in a question to me that I probably had had no relations with Congress in any way until I became chief of staff. And I said, no, that was not correct. I had a relationship with Congress that went back to my early boyhood. And so my mind was not entirely the military mind which they so often would claim when they were opposed to what I was saying. They wished to know what that connection was, and I told them of the cottonseed. And they were very much amused at that, and I said I never had any other relationship with my congressman after that. The cottonseed experience was enough for me. I got a great amusement out of our black-breasted red bantam chickens. The hens looked almost like quail, lacking the top knots. The roosters, of course, were highly colored with long tails, black tails, and the red plumage with the black breast. But they contented themselves largely with strutting around. But the hens were not only appeared a little like quail, but they flew a little like quail. And when I would open the hen house up after they'd been shut in for the night to save them from any animals who might destroy them, They would generally take flight and sail up to the top of the apple trees. And this is particularly the case if they'd been shut in during very snowy, cold weather. But it was quite a sight to see them all break loose like a flush covey of quail and sail up into the top of the apple trees. Another incident of my boyhood always strikes me as amusing. In those days, there were paper, large, thin paper novels, the Nick Carter series, the Frank Merrill series, the Old Sleuth series. We were forbidden from reading all but the Frank Merrill series, and those were highly recommended. And therefore, while they were very well adapted to boyhood, they were a little bit despised because they were approved. In order to read the Nick Carter series, which was very much like Jesse James at his best, we would retire to this spring house. Well, I think I told this, didn't I? Cancel that. I'm retelling the same thing. You asked the question as to how I probably became interested in the Army. Well, frankly, I don't know. I recall that at the earliest school I went to, Miss Thompson's, that at recess, I used to try to drill a company of boys with stick guns, and they would march at my command. I have a dim recollection that they didn't like it, and we didn't do too much of it, but that we did do this at recess. That's the only key I can give to my military desire, except that when my brother went off to school, and a military school, with a very famous record of fighting during the war, and I'd been taken over that battlefield at Newmarket, I was intensely interested in that sort of thing. And my interest was much increased by the fact that we met Colonel Charles Marshall of Baltimore at that time, who was a very, very distant, highly collateral relative, who had been Lee's aide during the war. And he talked quite a bit to Mother, and I think he was responsible for the interest that developed in sending my brother to the VMI, where I followed. Other than that, and the fact that I, more or less like all boys, we always played fighting Indians in the woods and things of that sort, I don't know otherwise why I should have espoused a military career. Wait a second. There were no particular ancestry of mine, that is, near to me, of a military nature. I've already told of my father being captured when he was about 16, I believe, by Basil Duke, who was a cousin, in the home guard defense of their town, Augusta, Kentucky. He was released by Duke after he'd gotten down to Frankfort, Kentucky, I think. I know that two of my father's brothers were in Lee's army. He was just a boy in the home guards, which in its essence, I guess, was federal, was Union. You asked me about my comments on the developments during my youth, such as the automobile, the airplane, and other phenomena. As a matter of fact, both of these two occurred after I had left home. I saw very little of my home after I went away to school, because there was no vacation during the winter. We had to be present even at dress parade, evening parade on Christmas Day. And if we didn't have a special permit, we had to be there for lunch on Christmas Day. And this and the session ran sometimes up into July, but as a rule about the 15th or 20th of June. And when I would come home, the family would be, as a rule, off in the mountains. They were nearby. They were about 2,500 feet high at the highest point nearby. And there were a number of old mountain houses where you could board very reasonably and get a wealth of food, particularly chicken, broiled chicken, gravy and waffles and honey. I know I had a record of 23 quarters of waffles one time. It's a wonder it didn't kill me. But then the family would not come back until it was time for school. So I was away from home practically all summer, and I was completely away from home while I was off at school at the VMI. So my intimacy with the home life more or less ceased when I was 16 years of age. I don't recall the introduction of electricity. We had carbon street lights, and which killed hundreds of thousands of bugs, and had to be cleaned of bugs almost every day. I remember that. I don't remember the other lights and their introduction, though it may have happened at that time. My family came all from Kentucky on my father's side, and halfway from Kentucky on my mother's side. Her father was a doctor in Augusta, Kentucky, who went to a medical school in Philadelphia, Jefferson Medical School, I believe. And there he met his wife, who was the daughter of a man named Bradford. No, that's... she was the daughter of a very well-to-do, able businessman in Pittsburgh. He incidentally owned a great deal of the property down on the point, which has now been made beautiful through the Equitable Life Insurance Company, I believe. He owned property all over Pittsburgh, mostly farm property. And when the National Pike crossed the river at Monongahela, 35 miles away, he sold this property and bought extensive property on either side of the pike at Monongahela City. And of course, when the railroad developed Pittsburgh, Monongahela City fell flat. The great traffic over the pike died away. The great Conestoga wagons became a thing of the past. And his wealth was very much decreased, though he was still a very well-to-do man. His one daughter of his never married and lived to be, I think, 96, though I'm not quite certain of this. But she was my great aunt, and she lived with us quite a bit of the time. She was a very remarkable woman in her intelligence and retained her faculties, mental faculties, up until the last. I remember my brother and myself going to see her the last time I ever saw her alive, and she was questioning him about his studies at the VMI, and he was specializing in chemistry, going to be a chemical engineer. And she wanted to know where he was in his progress in that study, and he spoke of Davy's atomic law. She immediately recited it, and I asked him afterwards, and he said she had that word for word, and she hadn't had to do with it since she was 18 years old. So she was a very brilliant woman intellectually. And I remember even in those days when she had to read with a large magnifying glass, that she read her Hebrew Testament and her French Bible every morning. She'd had a great many interesting experiences, and she recorded them all. And I think somewhere I mentioned that she rode horseback to and from a number of times from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. I recall one incident regarding the family, which was a profound irritation to my father. He was very much interested in the genealogy of the family, very much so, and was very proud of our connection with John Marshall. As a matter of fact, John Marshall was a very distant collateral relation. The family, his family, his father Thomas Marshall and his brothers, went to Kentucky, and they left him in Virginia, or rather he chose to stay in Virginia, and his great reputation grew up there along with his charm of his personality in Richmond, while his father and brothers settled near Maysville, Kentucky, at a place called Little Washington, And I remember going to visit there in my youth with my mother to some of her old friends when we were down in Kentucky visiting her brother in Augusta. The point that I recalled that rather delights my recollection today was there was a book. There is a book. You can find it in the Congressional Library on the Marshall family. I had a copy in my younger days, but I lost it in all of my books being flooded in transportation on one of my trips to the Philippines. Anyway, there were other copies. The other children, my brother and sister, both had copies. And incidentally, I'm sending you separately an outline of this book so far as it refers to me, relates to me, which my secretary at the time in the War Department, when I was chief of staff, had compiled in order to mimeograph and answer questions which were continuously coming in and about me and my progenitors, so that you can see just what it is. But to go back to the book, it didn't interest me at all because I wasn't mentioned. I was born too late. My brother and sister were mentioned, but my father and mother and brother and sister just got a mere brief paragraph of about two or three sentences. Well, that wasn't very exciting. As I say, I wasn't mentioned, so I wasn't at all interested. But there was one portion of the book that I did enjoy immensely. It was a description of one Marshall lady who married a famous pirate of South Carolina coast, of depredations in the Caribbean and otherwise. He was, I believe, called Blackbeard. I haven't got the book here, so I can't check. Anyway, he was a terror, and he was afterwards, I believe, captured by Lieutenant Maynard of the Navy and hung by the yardarm in execution of his crimes. That was near Charleston, South Carolina. Well, I enjoyed very much reading about Blackbeard and his atrocities. That was the only interesting thing I found in the book. I enjoyed it so much that I took it out of the house and took it to either the school or somewhere with my friends and read it to the boys, and they liked it very much. And while boys always have quite romantic conceptions of who their progenitors are, and they generally have them very celebrated people, very ferocious possibly, I had them all beaten because I had a pirate who was had a very bloody, cruel history with a long beard to help out. Well, it seems some father had heard this mentioned by his son at the supper table. And anyway, he poked a little fun at my father, who was quite sensitive about his family. And father was perfectly furious that out of all of this book, which he thought showed a fine line of progenitors, I had chosen Blackbeard as the only one that interested me and had publicized him in the town as being descended from a pirate. Have you turned it on? I'm going to your questions, first on ancestry. One, I think I've said all I care to say about my ancestry. Two, I do not know just where the name Catlett came from, except that there are Catletts in Kentucky, and you have Catlettsburg as a town. Next is home. Three, our home place in Uniontown is not standing. It's been built over, and the low ground filled up. That's where I spoke of a 20-foot fill, blotting out a good many of the spots of my youth. I've already pretty much described the house, and you have a description of the place. I might say that there was one thing that figured in my boyhood, and I've always regretted that my parents didn't enliven my interest till it would have had a great educational value. In my chum's yard, there was a honey locust tree, and it was about 20 feet from their spring house, from their wash house, where the week's washing was always done. Between the wash house and the honey locust, there was a deep trail about you could rest your thumb in it, and a continuous procession of ants going and coming to the tree or to the wash house. And those going in one direction would generally carry some little white burden. Well, we would lie and watch these ants by the hour when we had nothing else to do, when we completely ran out of playtime affairs, and we would watch this ant procession. There'd be these great floods which would put that portion of their yard under about 2 feet of water, but after the floods were over, the ants would return. When I went back to Uniontown for a reception after I was made chief of staff, I was very curious about the trail of the ants. And I went down to this house, which was still standing, but was rented by some seemingly Lithuanian. I could hardly understand him. But he was an old man sitting there in a rocking chair. And I asked him if I might go out and look in the yard, and he told me I could. And I couldn't find this trail. The springhouse, of course, was gone, but the honey locust was still standing. When I came back, I told him what I was looking for. And he said I was turned around as to the location of the wash house, and he pointed out where it really was, and I went out there, and I immediately found the trail of the ants running exactly as it had in my boyhood so many, many years before. I've often thought if they had given us a big magnifying glass and some book on insect life, that we probably would have become very deep students of it and gone into the other manifestations. As it was, it was merely the ants, the long trail, and the burdens they carried. 5. My father's home in Augusta is still standing, and I believe my mother's too. My father's was a 3-story brick house, and took up with its grounds the block in which it was located. In that part of the country, it was quite different from Virginia. From eastern Virginia, there were no great country houses. They were almost always in the towns. My recollection of my father's home was that it had a very wide brick hall right through the center of the house, very wide. And that was overlooked by a balcony off which the bedrooms opened. A very curious formation. It was more or less ruined in prospect by the fact that the railroad came through, CNO, I think, and came into the side of the town very close to the house. Parents. 6. Fry's comments on the family seem to be correct, as nearly as I can recall, except he doesn't mention, as far as I know, that Basil Duke was a relative. His comment about the marshals participating in the home guard action against Basil Duke, I don't think is justified by the history of those days. The raiders had burnt some village covering a ford into Ohio at one time, as I recall, and this time they were expected to burn the town in order to protect the ford. And just why it was protected, I don't know, but they were headed for a raid into Ohio. And for that reason, the home guards turned to defend the town, but there were apparently a great many Union sympathizers in the town. But as I said, in my father's family, 2 brothers were in the Lee's army, and the oldest member of the family, a sister, ended up by marrying a Union colonel who'd been wounded, and she nursed him. That was accountable later on for my father going north and getting a position with an iron furnace, because he was a furnace man and in his early days a very well-to-do man. The legend is that after this fight, which largely centered around my father's home, this older sister, who married the Union colonel, came out of the cellar and was met by Duke, who came in to find if any of the family had been hurt. And she's said to have met him on the lawn and slapped his face and ordered him out of the yard. I don't know how true any of this is. 7. I think he's right about my father. Fry is that, about joining the Masons and the Knight Templars. his Masonic interests were very intense and always took him one or two nights a week away from home. I remember a very ludicrous incident. I think he had the high post in his lodge at this time. He was either preeminent commander or past preeminent, whatever they call him. And he brought home his robes, which looked very much like a Catholic bishop, like an Episcopal bishop's robes, to get my mother to mend them. And she mended this tear, my sister helping her, advising her, or commenting on it. And when my father tried them on, after she mended them, mother and sister, Marie, were hilarious because it developed he'd been wearing them backwards for years. He was very sensitive about this, outraged at their levity, and they were just continuously amused every time they spoke about it. My father was very fond of shooting, and it was a very good shot, and the hunting was wonderful around there, quail, grouse in the mountains and so on. And he's very fond of fishing, and I believe a very fine fisherman, and he was very good at what I believe they call salmon pike, a very large fish which they found in the Youghiogheny River. Not so far from home in a direct line, but very far in the way we had to go in those days. I remember he's taking me up several times bass fishing, and it was very hard walking because the banks of the stream were covered with huge rocks, about a quarter of the size of a house sometimes, and I had great difficulty in climbing over them at my age, if you could climb over them. I remember on one occasion, which is my most famous fishing exploit, even to this day, my father's two companions and my father had not had a strike all day. And in the afternoon, about 2 o'clock, they decided to go to a place called Rattlesnake Hole, which was 2 or 3 miles upstream. Well, of course, the walking would be very difficult, as there was no real shoreline there, only these great piles of rocks. And my father knew I would not be able to make it. So he very generously and unselfishly declined to go with them and went off to occupy me fishing where we'd not been able to get a strike all day. We went up to a great rock which had halved off, which left a flat surface about on one side, about 3 feet above the water, which was in quite a pool as the river ran in alternate pools and rapids. I had one of my father's old rods, but I didn't have a reel. He didn't think I'd be capable of managing a reel. And when he baited my hook with minnows, two minnows, I threw it in, and he was going to bait his own when I got a strike, the first strike of the day, for any of us. And when I began to tow these fish in, I had two bass, one on each hook. My father had to help me land them, and when we got them in, we had to lift them quite a ways out of the water because we were about 2 or 3 feet up. He had to get them off the hook and re-bait my hook. And then he turned back to his own line, and before he got his own straightened out, of course he had a reel and fly and all that sort of thing. I had another strike, and he had to abandon his preparations and help me land my fish. Well, to cut this story short, we caught in the neighborhood of 30 bass, which I caught a fair part. I delayed all of his catching because he always had to help me land my fish. I had no reel, and we didn't want to break the leader on the line. And that was the finest fishing anyone had had up there for years, and my finest run of bass fishing that I've ever had. I've caught larger bass, but never so many bass, all standing in one place. We went back home to this mountain house where we were staying, because we had all the bass our reel would carry, and we had strung some which we were carrying outside of that, and went up and got a bath and went to a big mountain supper. Father's two friends didn't get back till after dark. They'd never had a strike all day, and when they found him with this tremendous collection of bass, their expressions, even to a boy of my age, were interesting. I will see if I can find any photographs. I have none but my things, possessions of that nature, have largely been lost or destroyed in the many moves I made to the Philippines several times, and to China, and typhoons, and other places in the United States, and a careless attitude on my part to all such manner of thing. My father was a very handsome man. He was about 5 feet, 9 or 10, a heavy mop of hair, very strong features, and blue eyes, carried himself very erectly, was very fond of walking. I remember on one occasion when we were up in the mountains about 7 or 8 miles away across a ridge of the Chestnut Ridge Mountains, he walked out of church and was lonely for the family, and in his striped pants and cutaway coat of that day and cane, he walked straight up into the mountains by a shortcut trail and arrived at our house in time for the midday meal. My mother was a very quiet woman, but with a great deal of character, a great deal of strength of character. As I said, she had a keen sense of humor and always observed with much interest the passing people on the streets, and of course they were very much the same people day after day in the life of the town. I think one explanation, a partial explanation, of being unable in later years to find much of a record of my father and mother is the fact that the town in my youth was about 5,000 people, and the next time I went back to it, I believe they told me it was 35,000. Well, that had pretty much drowned out the former life of the town. I know I found very few people I knew, and my boyhood acquaintances had largely moved away. My brother and sister left home very early in their young life, and my mother finally left and lived with my sister, spending her winters at Haddon Hall in Atlantic City. So her departure from home occurred fairly early of my life period, and the town completely and utterly changed, particularly in its relationship of people in social life. And I find very few families now that identify with the old days. I remember when I was given this reception in Uniontown after I was made chief of staff, they had a dinner for me, which I believe I mentioned, at the old White Swan Inn. But this was the new building in which the dining room was located on the site of the former cobblestone courtyard. I didn't realize at the time I was talking at that dinner, when I was called on, that it was being put on the broadcasting of a shortwave affair there at home. So that I told a great many of the stories of my youth in order to avoid anything in relation to the war situation, war having just developed on the 1st of September, and this must have been about the 10th or 15th of September. I was appointed chief of staff on the 1st of September, though I'd been acting chief of staff since the previous July the 1st. Not realizing that this was being broadcast, though locally, I was astonished when the people passed by to shake hands with me afterwards, and incidentally, it was not an arranged affair, and I was on one side of the table, and they were on the other as they passed, and it forced me to do a lot of leaning over to shake hands with them. But the thing that interested me and amused me, too, was that here would come by a lady in evening dress, and right behind her would be a fellow in his shirt sleeves, maybe his sleeves rolled up, maybe half a little bit tight. I remember one fellow I remembered of my youth, who was quite a character, I don't want to identify him further, and he had a heavy load on, and he was right between two ladies, both of whom were in evening dress, and he got to me and took my hand. He'd heard this broadcast in the bar room where he was, and he and a great many had come down to see me right away, because I was talking of their time and their events, and they had appeared in some of my stories that I'd recounted on that occasion. And he told me about this and how glad he was to see me and how innocent he was in what I said. And he interlarded about every fourth word with a violent curse word. And these two women stood there in their evening dress just being showered with curses. It made a very mixed up affair. But it was, I must say, I was innocent and amused. The change in the life of the town, I say, was complete. In addition to that, the region had been opened up in its coal and coke, being first, I think, expanded by the Federal Steel Company, who brought a great deal of coal and coke there. My chum's father, the banker, had very carefully and very judiciously invested in coal land and became immensely wealthy and immensely powerful, and made a large number of the young men who worked for him in connection with his bank and all also wealthy. And that developed quite a thing. I remember there was one fella who was a bark stripper up in the mountain, and he had gotten connected up with some of this coal land, and he'd made a great deal of money, and he was famous at the Waldorf Astoria, and everybody liked him there because he was so rough, he was an uncut diamond, and everything he said was more or less amusing, and it was certainly a shock to any New Yorker who patronized the famous row that the women used to parade on in those days. And my father was rather sensitive about things and rather high-tempered when he got stirred up. My mother was very calm and more or less deliberate. I remember my last licking. I was squirting the hose and cleaning the brick pavement in front of the house, free of all dust, which I had to do before school, when I thought my sister was coming to the door, and she'd been jeering me out the window, the upstairs window. So as she opened the door, I turned the hose on her, and I hit her square. And she screamed, and I continued to play the hose on her. And she couldn't call much because the water would go in her mouth. And finally, when I varied it a little bit, I discovered I was sprinkling my mother, and I was in a great dilemma. She, after she recovered her glasses, was rather shocked, but very much amused because she knew the terrible plight I was in, which arrived very shortly with my father. He needed no explanations at all, but he took me into camp, and that's the last licking I ever recall getting, which my mother at first laughed halfway through and then became sympathetic with me, but without much avail. In the home life, I realize today I got a great deal of benefit from reading. My father read aloud very well and liked to do it, strange to say. My mother read to me a great many things like Ivanhoe and all that series of books, but her eyes went back on her and she couldn't read much anymore. And then my father liked to read, and we all liked to listen. And he read a great many things. I recall some of them. Remember the Saracinesca City series, San Hilario, Don Orsino, of our writer who lived in Rome. I remember the Fenimore Cooper stories that he read to us, and particularly the famous story by Conan Doyle, which begins at the court of Louis XIV, Madame de Montespan and Madame de Maintenon in Versailles, and then goes with these fleeing people who wouldn't change their religion. They came to America and landed at Quebec. They were pursued all the way by a member of the church, of the Catholic Church, and I'm suffering from one of these failures to remember names, but this religion, which a great many settled all over North America and contributed a great deal to American life. They're very industrious and a very clever people. You will know right away what I'm talking about. Anyway, when they got to Quebec, they had to flee from this priest who was after them. And Conan Doyle gives a marvelous description of their passage through the Canadian forest, trying to keep away from the Iroquois Indians. They finally paused to rest with the forest chateau, you might call it, of this titled Frenchman who has married an Iroquois Indian chief's daughter. And he persists in all the procedure of the French seigneur, the grand seigneur, in France. Finally, this party moves on with a famous scout taking them, Grisolon Duluth, and they find the fort they're going to has been besieged, burnt down, and the garrison are tied to the trees, scalped, and of course dead. They come back, return to this chateau, as it were, and have a very perilous and marvelous trip through the forest, these great timbers, and their scout, their guide, Gracelyn du Lhut, saves them in the most remarkable way. Then the Indians encircle and attack this chateau, and finally, at the last, take it in a desperate fight. And these people are all captured, and then, of course, they are freed by a relief party from another fort. But it's one of the most thrilling accounts of that sort I've ever read, and his description of the appearance on the trail of this Iroquois chieftain on the warpath with his son beats anything I've ever read of that kind in my life. But there were any number of these books my father read to us, and I remember them today very clearly, and it's a delightful recollection. I'm sorry I can't at the moment remember the names, because they're everything leading of that day, and our evenings when he was home, at least several nights a week, were spent in listening to his reading. I'm very sorry I can't remember more of the books, because they were all the conquest of Mexico was one of them, and well, that's all I can do for this. To go back to the photographs, there are photographs of the family, and I don't know where they are. I haven't got them. My sister has them, what they are, and I think Ms. Marshall has one or two. But my photographic history ended rather abruptly during the dancing school days, in the same building where they had the dancing